Hello and welcome back to Theology Upstream podcast. This is Chrissy and Ben, and we're here for one final time for a little while
That's
on
right.
Theology Upstream. We are still in Warp Speed going through our book, Incarnate by Michael Frost, and we're going to go through chapters 11, 12, 13, and 14 today in the next 45-ish minutes.
Another
So
whirlwind round.
I know, get ready, hold on to your seats. These are a little harder to synthesize than the previous four, but we're going to do our best.
We're just going to jump over huge sections, is what we're going to do.
Yeah, picking and choosing.
That's right.
Isn't that Marcion who did that?
Yeah,
There we go.
absolutely.
So
And
we're well
Thomas
grounded.
Jefferson. Many people have tried to do that.
We have, well-respected predecessors in some circles. In some circles, they're heretics. But before we get into today, I wanted to let you guys know what's going on next with the podcasting at Myers Park Baptist. Ben, why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, first I have to say, since this is our last podcast, how much I've enjoyed podcasting with Chrissy. I'm going to miss so much. All right, enough of that
That's
sappy
so
stuff, but
emotional.
let's move on. Anyway, I've really
Thank
enjoyed
you.
it, and we'll miss it for a while. We're going to take a little break as you get settled in your new setting. But in the meantime, our Awakening Shalom podcast will kick off in January, and I'm going to be joined by Bethany Johnson, one of our church members, who's also a professor at UNC Charlotte. And she and I are going to be reading together and talking together with you about a book entitled, a very popular book right now, entitled The Body Is Not an Apology, The Power of Radical Self-Love by Sonia Renee Taylor. And it is a very embodied book. And just the quote, "the body is not an apology," has been something that's become part of my lingo now. So like when I like fall asleep on the couch and Katie's like, "hey, you fell asleep." I'm like, "body's not an apology." You know? You try it sometime with your family.
If I'm sure it's a real winner with the spouse.
If you have to go to the bathroom randomly and you just like disappear for a couple hours.
Okay, any staff that's listening, at the next staff meeting at exactly the moment when Ben gets really excited about something, everyone get
Sorry.
Up and leave.
We got to go. The body's not an apology. Yeah, 5-minute bio break, Ben. Sorry. Anyway, we hope you'll join Bethany and I as we walk through that book together and begin podcasting on Awakening Shalom.
That's so, right. I'm so excited that you guys are going to do that.
She's such a great teacher, and it was amazing having her as a part of the Body series so far. So this is going to be fun.
Yep. She's also teaching January 9th at the next Awakening gathering. So everyone should come.
Y'all should come out.
Bethany's one of the smartest people I know, and the body topic is like one of her major areas of expertise. So she's so good.
She's a captivating teacher, too.
Yep. All right.
All right, let's dive in.
Back to Frost.
Back to Frost.
We're really good at transitions.
It's frosty right now, and we're reading about incarnation. It's very Christmassy on this podcast.
It is.
Yeah,
Joe,
it's
are you
festive.
Listening?
Joe said, "what does this hell have to do with Christmas?" It has to do everything with Christmas.
Sorry, it's incarnation.
Incarnation.
Embodiment.
Speaking of embodiment, in this chapter, Frost really moves, as we talked about last in our last podcast, about how grounded and rooted in a particular place bodies need to be. This sort of, we've been kind of dealing with this, the connection between body and land, like for a long time now, since we've been talking about indigenous stuff, since we've been talking about immigration, since we've been talking about race. We've been dealing with this idea that the body and our bodies and land are connected together. We talked about how Mother Earth is treated like a woman, so the way we treat the world and, you know, is sort of the way we treat women. It's just this, all this connection. So Frost really dives in on how we are placed people, and we, our bodies have the story of a place with them. We're born in a particular place. People ask, well, where are you from? You know?
Yeah, and I think another way of saying a similar thing is to say we're a storied people. Hmm. So for those of you who have trouble with the land, like talking about it with land, you can talk about it in the way of history.
Right.
So, you know, if you've been in the same city for 75 years, you understand the culture and the unspoken pieces of the culture about the city, whereas if you come in and spend a year.
Right.
So it's understanding the stories and being connected.
But almost nobody's been anywhere for 75 years.
I know.
I mean, we have a few. One of the things about a church is that you have people in your church usually who have been in the community for 75 years, 100 years, a couple generations. But the society is now so mobile that we struggle to have people who have that deep sense of place.
Yeah.
And sometimes within a church, you can have a deep tension or even argument or conflict that arises between people who have a deep sense of place and those who are more cosmopolitan and have come from many other places, like – New York, Chicago, Cincinnati, Washington, D.C., and then now to Charlotte.
Yep.
Or those who've been in Charlotte for 75 years, and getting them on the table and talking to each other about what their values are and what they care about can be a very startling experience.
It is. And I think there's another tension that's woven into this mess with us, because all of what we're talking about today is related to churches and people and cities. So if you think about all the different stories and histories and places of those things, when you pull people together who aren't all from the same place, but they all find themselves at the same church. But you think about a church that was specifically founded for a neighborhood.
Yeah.
Or for a people who live in a neighborhood.
Right.
And then
they can walk there.
They can walk there. And there's pride in that, because it's like theirs. It's like the same pride you have in a public school that is yours.
It's our money. We built it. We put it together. We created it. We named it.
That's right. But the tricky thing about church is this whole business of, like, you know, spreading the good news.
you're trying to be for others,
but you're also trying to grow.
Yeah.
And over time, as cities, you know, like Charlotte specifically, has grown so much and changed so much in the last 75 years.
Right.
So it's impossible to be a neighborhood church and still survive.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got to have commuters.
Well, it's a great example. We've talked about this, I think, even on the podcast, about the difference. One of the tensions that comes up, for instance, is like, there's this tradition at our church of, well, we never close, no matter what the weather is, no matter what the issue is, no matter what hurricane, tornado, typhoon, snowstorm, icy roads, we never close. Well, where did that come from? It comes from the 75 history of a time where there was always people that could walk to church. But now most of our staff live many, many miles from the church, because the neighborhood is so affluent and has grown in that way and has priced out the people who work at the church and work in any social service organization in the city.
Right.
Can't afford to live in the neighborhood. But the church still lives there and still exists there and draws many people. And now we have a wellness center and we have a school and we have people from all over coming from different areas within the church. So people who work there, we have people who come to church there, and the people who attend the church are not all from the neighborhood anymore either. So the questions about things, it's a cultural question about whether we close or not. It reflects that history of being a neighborhood church and yet now being a church that's for the whole city, and actually it's for the whole county, actually it's for the whole state, for the whole nation. I mean, we have people watching online from Arizona, California.
I know. Well, and I mean, having been a part of this place for just 8 years, like, I think we see ourselves as being a church for the world.
Yeah.
Or a church for the country. You know, we have a message that's distinct and that we're proud of. And to limit it only to this neighborhood is not who we are.
I sometimes joke with people that we're better known outside the state than we are in our own neighborhood.
I think there's a lot of truth to that.
Because the people know our reputation, particularly in the Baptist world. All the other Baptist churches in the country know Myers Park Baptist. There's a history there.
Yep.
But if you were, you know, a random Episcopalian living in Myers Park, you would have no idea who we are.
Yeah.
Or a random, you know, atheist, which is most of the population now.
I know.
Who don't go to church, right? And don't care.
So that kind of identity has an interesting tension with what Frost is saying the church is intended to be.
Yeah.
Which is an organization that is placed and rooted and long-term.
Right.
In community, in neighborhood.
Yeah. So what we're seeing is that means that the church has reflected what has happened in society. The church now reflects the ways neighborhoods have shifted all across the country. You know, it's not like there's just a city, a hub with little neighborhoods around it, and you have a church and you go to the church in your neighborhood. You have a car, so you can drive to whatever church you want.
Right.
It's capitalism, so pick and choose, right?
Right?
You not only have a car, you have an internet, and you can watch whatever church you want on television or on your computer or whatever.
Yeah.
You have a train or you have a bus. You can get to different churches. You don't have to go to the church in your neighborhood anymore. So if you want to, you can make a choice to go to a different place. And that has changed, and the fact that people are mobile, they don't live in the same neighborhood, they move around town, they move out of town to different states. So the church is really just reflecting the way society itself has become less tied to place.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But creating a place, even in a place that doesn't have a sense of place, is a very important concept, I think.
Hold on. Say all that again?
Creating a place. Yeah. So I think even creating a place where people don't have a sense of place is important work.
Yeah.
So how do you get a sense of place?
Well, it's super countercultural.
Yeah.
Like, it's the most countercultural thing that you can do. So how do you get a sense of place?
Yeah. What comes with a sense of place?
I think Frost would say people connecting with people face to face in a room at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. So relationship.
Yeah.
Connection.
Yeah.
I think memory.
Yeah.
Traditions, rituals, practices, shared life together, stories that they share in common and trade with one another. I'm really talking about community. That you can't have a sense of place without a sense of community. They're sort of tied together, you know, because their stories are shared between people.
Yeah.
You know, you think about a people rooted to a piece of land, and the land itself has a story. You know, the land here has a story. It was Ephod's field, and then they gave it to the church, which is an incredibly generous gift, and then the church was built upon it with, you know, so that the land has a story beyond back before Ephod's field, right, where it was Catawba Indian land back before Charlotte was ever founded. And, you know, there's lots of stories. And you have to share those stories to create a sense of place around. And the church has a sense of place because people have the story of who we are. And our sense of place is rooted deeper and deeper the more we can share a common story about who we've been that we all agree to share in common, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think that there are so many interesting challenges with that.
Yeah.
Like to agree on the history should be simple.
There you go. No, it's not.
But it's not.
Yep.
And it's not because we don't ever want to be honest about our history.
Nope.
You know, no European American wants to talk about how we got the land.
Yeah, gosh.
Because it's not a good story.
I thought you were going to talk about Myers Park history because I was like, we don't even want to be honest about that. But you're like, we don't want to be honest about any part of history.
We don't want to be honest about how we got our land.
Right.
Or how we've kept it. Or how we've earned the land, you know, today. Because it's just not as pretty as we like to think that it might be.
Yeah.
But in addition to that, there's a level of commitment around holding and curating and cultivating the stories.
Mm-hmm.
And to be really placed in community takes time and energy, and it takes commitment, and it takes a reprioritization of what we do each week. Because, you know, when we started this conversation, it was about how do you create a sense of place in a city where there is no sense of place?
Yes.
Or in a church where there is no sense of place or whatever. It requires people choosing church community over all the other things that they could be doing.
Yes.
Because they've got to give that stuff up to be here.
That's right.
To create the place.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be interesting if we had, like, designated storytellers?
That would be interesting.
Right? Like their job is to just tell the story of who we are.
Yeah.
Right? And to tell it in different ways and at different times to different groups of people. And they were – it's usually – because in most cultures, that's what your elders were.
Yeah.
Your elders were your storytellers. They would come – they would keep – they were the bearers of the community's story in their body, you know, and they would share the story. And the people knew that the story was so important that they would go and listen to the story all the time. We're trying to do – that's kind of what worship really is. But it could also be what a congregational meeting is.
Yeah. Well, I think we've done that in the 75th year. We've had stories called in. I mean, there's a little bit of an oral history that we've collected.
That's true.
With different people sharing their memories.
Yeah.
And I think the piece that I'm missing – is perhaps an incarnational piece, right? We've had people call in and share their stories. We have people type in their stories, and we have played them, or we've listened to them or read them on our own time. But there's not been a forum where there's been interaction around the story. Because I think when the story is not held in conversation with people living the present story, then the story is sanctified in a way that disallows for change.
We need a talk back for a story.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, because people have to be able to say, I hear you tell the story, but here's where I come in the story, and I don't see it the way you see it.
Yeah.
I have this. Yeah. This is my story and how my story impacts the larger, broader story.
Yeah.
And they have to be able to give that all sort of alternative witness.
Yeah.
Right? The dissenting report or just a broader perspective to it.
Mm-hmm.
That creates a sense of place too, because then the story is dynamic.
Exactly. And it's dynamic with the people who are placed within it.
Right. Right. That would be amazing.
I think so. You should do that, Ben.
Well, see, the thing is, I shouldn't be the one just telling the story. We should have somebody else tell the story and then have to deal with talk back about it.
I know. That's what I'm saying. Like, you should make that happen.
Okay. Thanks.
Put that on your January list.
Another parting duty assigned to me by Chrissy.
You guys, it's so fun to give Ben things to do. Well, we have a friend in Charlotte who is a really excellent storyteller.
That's right. Greg Jarrell, who some of you know because he and his wife Helms and their family founded QC Family Tree and live on off of Tuckasegee mm-hmm. Road,
yep.
In West Charlotte, and have lived there for over 10 years.
Yeah.
And came there right out of seminary and have lived there doing rooted discipleship in that area and building relationships and community with their neighbors. And Greg has just written a new book about West Charlotte and his neighbors and his relationships and what it's like to live there and do rooted discipleship for 10 years. And it's a phenomenal read. It's called A Riff of Love, and I would highly recommend it. We have some of our deacon leaders who are reading it right now, and it is an exceptional book about Charlotte. It's a great book about Christianity. When you put the two of those together and you add jazz, because Greg is also a great saxophonist and jazz musician who leads our jazz worship services when we do them and helps us put those on. When you integrate jazz, Christianity, West Charlotte history and community, and then you deal with issues like gentrification and race and socioeconomic questions all in the same book, what you have is a masterpiece, and it's really an extraordinary look at the issues in our city. Now, Greg and Helms made a very intentional choice. I use that word intentionally because they are living in intentional community, creating a hospitality house there in West Charlotte, and have done so for over a decade. Many people who are Christians are not going to have that calling.
But at
the same time, their calling testifies to us about how important it is to be grounded and rooted in a particular place,
yep.
right?
Yep. Every time I think about them, I remember when I first moved to Charlotte, and I was really young, and first moved here after school, you know, aside from growing up, of course. But I called Helms when I found out about what they were doing.
Yeah.
And I called her and said, you know, what is it like to live in your community? And like, what kind of, do you accept new people? And I was trying to figure out, learning, like, is this something that we could do?
Mm.
And she was describing there's like a year of discernment. Greg and Helms could tell you a lot more. I mean, this is 8 years ago.
Yeah. Now.
But it became really clear for me in a troublesome way that I couldn't do what they were doing. And it's always been hard for me to think about that because I have so much respect and admiration for the way that they're living out their calling fully, that there's a tinge of guilt every time I see them because I'm like,
sure.
I'm not as good of a Christian as they are.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. We're not. We're just not.
But it begs the question that we kind of ended with last time on the podcast, which is if, you know, don't let it stop there. Don't say, you know, I can't do that much.
Right. I mean, it's funny because when we talk about like Greg and Helms or like some of the other folks who live in intentional community, Jonathan Wilson, Hartgrove, Shane Claiborne, there are many across the country. Sarah Jobe, a friend of mine, you know, that I've known for years. We don't say that when we hear about St. Francis, but somehow when it comes to intentional community people, we get really anxious.
Yeah.
You know, nobody's like, oh my God, St. Francis, I just ought to give up because he was such a great Christian. I should just stop being me.
Well, you know? I think that the issue is Francis lived a long time ago. And so we don't have to make the same choices that Francis had to make.
Yeah.
You know, like I think Julian Norwich is amazing
and
inspirational. I'm not tempted to go lock myself in the sanctuary.
Yeah.
People don't do that.
Right,
you know?
Right. But you are tempted by the idea of living in an intentional community.
And even the language of it, like, it reminds me that my community where I choose to live is not intentional.
Mm.
It is for the developer.
Sir, yes, exactly.
But it is not for me.
It was very intentional for the developer, but not for you.
Like, they bulldozed the mill and drew the neighborhood out.
Yeah, there were some intentions in our choices about where we want, but it wasn't the same kind of intention of creating a sense of community in place.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's so fascinating. I think, we're intimidated by it, I think, or jealous of it or guilt about it because it's sort of like present.
It is.
We look at it and we see like, oh my God,
you
know. But I think all of us have to remember like what's our call. We had a call.
That's
we were
right.
given a particular task to do and we have to do that faithfully with whatever responsibilities we have on top of that, whatever faithfulness looks like in our particular calling and vocation. So this goes back to our question about the roaring lambs last week. I keep using that language, the roaring lambs of that book from the 90s. They're supposed to be roaring lambs for Jesus wherever they work, in the bank, at the law office, roaring lambs, you know,
I've already forgotten that was a part of the last podcast episode.
You clearly don't like the image of roaring lambs.
Well, I'm just troubled by it.
You don't want to be a roaring lamb?
I feel like I will have nightmares about roaring lambs later.
They sound like those goats. You ever seen those goat videos where they're like, you know? But they sound like human beings.
No, I have not.
Okay, well,
I'm sending you every goat video I can find I'm changing
for the
my
next
email
3 weeks. Yeah.
You're going to have
lots of goat fun.
I was going to say something like meaningful and helpful.
Well, anyway, go ahead.
I remember it. But this is what, like, when you're talking about, we have to be true to our calling and how God is asking us or luring us or drawing us to kind of live into that calling of God on our lives. And I'm reminded of a Nadia Bells Weber quote that's in her book, Pastrix, when she's like, for the first time at the comedy club or in that space, kind of recognizing, like, her people are not church people. Mm. Her people are nightclub people. And so she's looking out and she's like, she has this moment where she's like, oh, these are my people, you know? And I remember texting the person who gave me the book, and I was like, that's the question.
Yeah.
Who are my people? It's almost like that child's book, Are You My Mother?
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, are you my people? And I think that's the constant question for a faith leader to be asking.
Mm.
And the response needs to always be available to be in motion. You know,
yeah.
Are you my people? Are you my people today?
And right,
and I
right.
think the other reminder parallel to that is that the gospel truly is for everyone.
Mm.
And it may sound different. You know, there may be a different message for the immigrant crossing the border than there is for the white girl who lives with papers in Charlotte.
Sure, sure.
And
yeah.
so, but being true to the word of the gospel for the people with whom you are rooted in community.
Sure. And I think you have to find yourself contextually within the gospel, right? And what the call to you is quite different depending upon where you are socially located.
That means being real honest about, like, am I Rome or am I the Samaritan?
That's right. Or who am I in Mary's song, for instance?
You have a real thing with Mary's song.
I love that song.
That's another Christmas piece
I
for
love
you,
her
Joe.
Or John the Baptist. Those are my favorite Advent characters.
There you go.
Somebody just wrote an article today that you're either one or the other. You have to choose. You have to choose which Advent character you want to be. And you can only have John or
Mary. Did you reject that dualism?
I don't know. I like it. Kind of like it. It's one of those dualisms that's attractive.
That's so dual. That's like, oh, there's so many dualisms there. Male, female.
I know. There's like a male,
pregnant,
female.
Not pregnant.
Yeah. Locust and honey, regular diet.
Engaged, unpartnered.
Yeah. Roaring lamb, bearded dude.
Chapter one, chapter two.
Exactly. That's so true.
Oh, we digress.
Yeah. Actually, chapter two, chapter three. John keeps going.
Shh. Don't grab the money.
Okay, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Anyway, speaking of place, you should read Greg's book and check out QC Family Tree and their awesome work of rooted discipleship. And you should look at this book as we continue to think about adopting an incarnational posture and moving forward into this sort of – I think the problem of the church being located in a particular neighborhood and all of us having to drive in as staff and clergy, which is a concern and a question about how can I build relationship, has a lot to do with the sort of internet culture that's mm-hmm. happening and the mobile culture that's happening as we move into this chapter 12 and his struggles with – what has the internet done to our brains and our bodies and our thinking? It is difficult to imagine what it might mean for Myers. Because you said, you know, we're a church for the city, we're a church right. for the state, we're a church for the world. But how do we be a church for the neighborhood? I'll tell you, the best thing we've done is the Cornwall Center trying to figure out how to be a church for the neighborhood.
Yeah.
But other than that, like, what does it mean?
Well, I would push that. I mean, I think we have been a church for the neighborhood through the Cornwall Center. I think we've been a resource for the neighborhood through the Cornwall Center.
Yeah,
I think,
like,
we've been a community for the neighborhood through the Cornwall Center.
Right. Okay.
But I want to know how we're being a conscience for the neighborhood.
Mm. Okay.
Through the Cornwall Center.
Through the
week school and through the church.
Right. That's right.
And how are those institutions, which are valuable resources?
Yeah.
To one another, kind of an ongoing relationship, and to the neighborhood. But how are we, where is our sense of conscience overflowing into those things, or our sense of call?
Yeah, I think it's interesting you said that, because you have to demonstrate you care about people before you can provide a conscience. And so I think we've demonstrated care. I mean, we're caring for how many children a week on this campus, you know?
Yeah, over 200.
Right. And how many folks are members of the Cornwall Center? I mean, we're talking about thousands of people. total that are accessing the campus, on caring for them. But what does it mean? Yeah, conscience. That's interesting. Well, what is it? What does mission or church mean in Myers Park?
You know, I think that's something a great question.
Something to discern, I think. For
add
us.
That to your January list.
Absolutely. Well, in the meantime, we need to wrestle with the fact that the internet has messed up our brains.
I know. What's the article? How Google is killing our brains?
Oh God! Yeah.
I thought that was incredible.
Yeah, I think. Well, the book "The Shallows" that he references at the beginning is some of the best research on that. Mm-hmm. It's a reminder to us that when I read that, I always keep thinking like, we've never gotten Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. You just can't create something and think that it's going to be great. Like, progress doesn't just mean more good things. Technology is used by humans, therefore can always become bad.
That's right.
Any piece of technology that is created, a chair. You build a chair, you think, oh, now we have a place to sit. Now I have something to hit you with, right? I mean, seriously, that's how humans think about technology, right?
I know, you're right. You're right. We're horrible.
So what you gave me the internet, and you told me it was going to be freedom, and it was going to be democracy, and now we have Facebook hacking elections, letting the Russians hack elections. I mean, this is what happens. Think of the dream of the founders of the internet, and look where we are now. This book was written before we found out what was going on with Facebook, and they were already worried about our brains.
That's exactly right.
It's amazing.
But Frost makes four suggestions, right, as to how we might overcome some of the negativity that comes along with
The internet's not going away, reality. So we got to figure it out.
Yeah. So he lays them out on page 164, and then I think for the next two or three pages he lays them out. So the first thing he says reminds me of Brené Brown. He says, anthropologically, we have to move in.
Yeah, what was her phrase again? It was like,
people are hard to hate up close, move in.
Yeah, and that even echoes back to Bryan Stevenson and Just Murray. He said, get proximate. Yeah. Isn't that interesting? All these books
Everyone's
like get
saying
closer.
The same thing.
Get closer.
And we
get
still
closer.
Can't do it.
We don't. Yeah, we struggle.
Yep. So we talked about doing that in community and kind of shooting towards the church as a place where that can happen.
Right. That should be.
People can get close together.
And I think people are going to find those places whether we provide them for them or not. Mm-hmm. And so we have to figure out what does it mean to create space for that kind of close up. Community interaction can happen.
Right. And one thing I love about just this section number one is he says, can you imagine marrying your spouse and then choosing to live separately? And I know people do that for, different reasons, but no one really, it's not like, let's get married and then have separate houses.
Yeah, right.
But think about, if you think about what it looks like when you're joining a church, I'm going to join the church, but I'm not going to show up for stuff.
Right. I'm not going to participate.
I need the church to be there for me, and I really desire that kind of deep-rooted spiritual community in my place.
Yeah.
But I can't come to dinner.
Well, it's sort of the difference between thinking of the church as a provider of service goods and services that are distributed to you and that you pay for or don't pay for because of their quality level and what you get from it. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you think of church more as your people, your community, then first of all, it's priceless. So you give what you can, no matter how much that is. And it's really not about the money. It's about the fact that you're there with these – it doesn't matter what the goods and services are. The worship may not hit you one week, but you're not there just for whether or not it was a great piece of music or an enlightening sermon. You're there because you're there for your community. The commodification of all things in culture is what leads to the church just becoming another provider of goods and services.
Yeah.
But the second one that that Frost drops on us is listening, empathetic listening. Mm-hmm. I just think that's a really hard skill for people to learn.
Yeah. I love that the third line of that, he's quoting someone else who says, listen to your patients. They are telling you how to heal them. I think that's a really kind of prophetic thing to hear, thinking about pastoring people.
Yeah, I think – and it's not always obvious what they're telling you, how they're telling you to heal them, but they're telling you what they're wounded by. That's for sure.
Yeah.
They're telling you where their wound is.
Yeah, they're speaking to the pain or the anxiety.
Right.
And it's not the words. It's what's behind
the
words.
It's what's behind the words and what's what the words bring out of them. Yeah.
Yep.
And I think the language of healing to me is really interesting because we always think about healing as cure or, what happens at a hospital. So it's either the left over-medicalizes it, the right turns it into some kind of superstitious miracle. Mm-hmm. But what really healing is walking with people toward wholeness,
Right.
And so if you, but if you, you can't do that until you identify the wound, which is why like Henry Nouwen's wounded healer stuff is so powerful. You've got to figure out your wound and they've got to figure out theirs, and then you can walk together toward wholeness. But if nobody knows what each other's wounds are and nobody's willing to be honest about what their wounds are, you know, then you're not going anywhere. So like if I tell you, if I'm telling you, well, I'm really wounded because I just, I'm so good at what I do, you know, but if or if I'm actually like, yeah, actually, you know, I'm really selfish. You know, like there's different levels of vulnerability around woundedness that we need to help with each other's healing.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to be vulnerable.
That's right. Another thing that that Frost suggests is to work collaboratively.
Yeah.
So to work in the neighborhood collaboratively, or to work intersectionally across the city, not
right.
just in your neighborhood, but
this is a place where we struggle because I think we're a church that invents our own nonprofits.
Yep.
In our history and creates our own movements. And we don't, that makes it harder for us to know how to partner.
Yeah.
And we struggle to figure out how to, what we want to do is reinvent the wheel every time. And instead of just figuring out who's doing the work in the city that we care about and going and saying, okay, y'all are leading on this. How can we help? You know, what can we do? We want to be involved.
Yeah.
Instead of just saying, you know, there needs to be another nonprofit for this and creating a whole new thing. That when there might be already something that exists.
Exactly. And I think, too, like some of the issues that we've tackled lately are pretty big. And so we want to have, like we've tackled in our heads, not incarnationally yet. But there are some things that we want to do around initiatives. Like what are we doing to solve this instead of who are we partnering with? Who's been doing the work and how do we join in?
Yeah, exactly. It may be that there's somebody already doing it.
Yeah. Hey, maybe they've been doing it for a long time.
For a long time, and that's the last one that Frost leaves us with, is sustainability. Stick
with it.
We're
going to give you one smooth transition in this podcast.
Yeah. No, no, we're not.
Well, there it goes. It's rough now.
So sustainability is important. You know, Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove has a whole book where he calls this the wisdom of stability and what it means to stay in the same place for a long period of time. And you think about Helms and Greg, they've been there for 10 years. You know, it's a long time to be in one place. I think those are helpful. I don't know exactly how they play out in a different kind of ministerial context or churchy context like ours. But, you know, I think partnerships, thinking about longevity, we've been in the neighborhood for 75 years, how to listen. Mm-hmm. It may be that there are certain ways that we can do these things more intentionally.
Yeah, definitely. Well, are we ready to go to 13?
Yeah, let's keep moving.
Okay. 13, so it's appropriate, I think, that we were abrupt here. Because 13 is kind of an abrupt beginning.
It is.
So we have all this stuff around like being a placed church and a rooted church and a neighborhood church. And what does that mean? And how does that countercultural? How does it pull us out of our excarnate digital selves and back into our skin and into our place? And then he starts chapter 13 with, on November 18th, 1978, in Jonestown, Guyana.
And this story is the story of Jim Jones, who many of you will know as the Kool-Aid Jamestown Massacre, which, as Frost reminds us, was the largest American catastrophe before 9/11. And it was the largest loss of life, where these people had moved to Jonestown, Guyana with Jim Jones and were convinced to participate in a group suicide pact. But the thing of this story that is mind-boggling is very few of us know that Jim Jones was a legit, serious, socially justice hero, warrior, doing interracial work and in his community long before he kind of lost his mind and was really amazing.
Right.
And it's sort of startling to read through who he was as a person and the kind of sacrifices that he made that were very risky kinds of discipleship and very progressive and very selfless. And he seemed to have like sort of all the right beliefs, and he was kind of going after all the injustices in society, dealing with race, dealing with economics, dealing with war, dealing with segregation.
Yeah.
And then something kind of flipped and he kind of lost his faith in Christianity. He lost his faith in God and began to think that he was God.
Right.
And it's an amazing backstory that we don't really know. And it's sort of wild that Frost just drops this here on chapter 13 for us.
I know, it is. And I think it's interesting because, like you said, many of us don't know the history there. I certainly didn't. So yeah. I'm listening to this. I'm like, hold on, wait a minute, rewind.
Yeah.
Let's play that again.
Yeah.
Like, this guy was working. I thought the story about him being hospitalized and, like, accidentally. Right. Or
in the Black Ward.
Yeah,
the...
yeah. He wakes up in the Black Ward and starts emptying the bedpans and,
yeah.
and, like, serving the other people who are there seeking health and healing.
Right.
And he won't leave, right?
So
and
he was there.
Because
of that, they have to desegregate the wards.
Exactly.
I mean, it's amazing.
Yep.
That's an amazing story.
And that the term Rainbow Family was originally...
Yeah, it's about him.
It's about him. And, yeah. He and his wife adopting children from all kinds of... racial and ethnic
and
backgrounds.
He really did think that he convinced people to come with him partly because of who he was as a social justice hero,
right.
An interracial justice hero, and building this Pentecostal. He even calls it like a socialist paradise that he's going to build in mm-hmm. Jonestown, and it's really haunting. But the switch, right, is this idea, first of all, that he loses all faith in any form of traditional Christianity, right. And he loses faith in God and begins to think he's the God.
Right.
That's sort of the switch
right.
that
and,
happens.
And there's this amazing line. I think you have it underlined also on page 177,
mm-hmm.
where it says, "Soon he began deriding traditional Christianity, rejecting the Bible as white men's justification to subordinate women and subjugate people of color, and stating that it spoke of a sky God when there was no God at all."
Mm. And then he said he was a reincarnation of Gandhi and Jesus and Buddha and Lenin.
Yeah.
Not a great group.
Vladimir Lenin.
Yeah, right.
That's important. Not John.
Not John Lenin. Vladimir Lenin.
Just
John Lenin
sure.
was still alive in 1970.
I know.
Yeah. I think it's – I mean this, he became a megalomaniac. So he lost it. All of the paranoia and everything just kind of got to him over time, and he lost his mind. And then he goes on this – he creates the suicide pact. But the thing that I think the reason Frost shares this is because he's saying, look, where it got unhealthy, where it went off the rails is when Jones thinks that the only way out is escape.
Right.
And there's many levels of escape here. The first escape is he thinks he can escape religion and mm-hmm. God
yeah.
and Christianity after having been in it his whole life.
Yeah.
Then he thinks he can escape America. Right, and leave what he's calling America, the fascist country. He thinks he can leave that, and somehow that's going to save all these people.
Mm-hmm.
Then he gets there, and he realizes I can't. Now I have to leave the world. So we have a suicide mm-hmm. pact. So think of the levels of escapism mm-hmm. that are happening through that. All of it is the world is too bad. Right. Again, it's sort of like look at. I love the fact that Frost, remember when you said that he never shares an example that you think he's going to share?
Yeah.
He always tells you the story that you would never have thought he would use, and you're like, what?
Yeah.
This is exactly that. This is that case in point, right?
Yeah, there's one in every chapter.
And so here, some people on the right will say, the world is going to end, apocalypse is coming, Jesus is going to come back,
yeah.
so what you do doesn't matter. And we all need to like make sure we're in Israel because that's where it's all going to start. And there's going to be 1,000 years together. And get sure you get your Bible study, and you're going to get raptured, and your clothes are going to be left. And so, why do we care about climate change? The whole thing's going to burn up anyway. We're going to heaven, so what does it matter? Like, there's this sort of radical: the world's going to end. The world is awful and evil and ugly. There's nothing good about the world. It's going to fall apart. So let's just and we go right. There's
yep.
like the hard conservative. Right.
Mm-hmm.
This is like an example of the opposite. The world is going to hell in a handbag. Everything's awful. So we got to leave.
Yeah.
The only way out is to suicide pact.
Yeah.
That's
funny. I wouldn't have said that left, but yeah, I get what you're saying.
It really was. Like, it's like social justice, fascism, socialism, losing your mind, thinking you're God. Now let's suicide pact. Like,
well,
it's all.
I think you could also say, though, that the another left perhaps is. Paralysis.
Mm.
I think mm-hmm. because I think in my mind, at least today, the right is still saying heaven,
yeah,
other world,
right.
Escape, get out of this world. This world's bad. That world's good. Let's focus on that one. Make sure
right.
we're right with God, and then we're going to be there.
Yeah.
But I think that the left is saying the world is ours. Take it or love
yeah.
it or not. This mm-hmm. is where we are. This
right.
may be all there is. Let's work on it for a little while.
Right.
But when they get really deep into that, as Jones was for a while, it's overwhelming and crushing and paralyzing. And so I think that one of the faults of the left right now is that paralysis and that inability or refusal to step one, you know, not to have it all right, but to move and to incarnate literally with our bodies, the love of God in this world now.
And all of these are like extremes where you decide that everything's awful. It's all, there's no going back. It can't be redeemed. That's right, the first thing. And then, so we're going to either, we go to paralysis or we escape.
Yeah.
We have these choices of trying to disappear and get out of here, or we get paralyzed and there's nothing we can do. Whereas if Jones, for instance, had just stayed and continued to do the work that he was doing in the neighborhoods with African Americans, with his family, working on issues of segregation, working on race, working on economics, and not sort of descended, either got burnt out or tried to escape or a combination thereof or lost his mind or whatever happened, you know, then he would have been holding in tension this idea that, yes, you know, their redemption is possible. God is here and the work is hard. It is ugly.
Yeah.
There is fascism. There is economic oppression. There is disparity. But I'm going to just stay in it and work on it.
Yeah.
And the problem is there's a sense of despair and hopelessness that comes with that, a pessimism.
Right. A pessimism. Mm-hmm.
Right? That it's hard when you only see incremental steps or it looks like it keeps getting worse.
Yeah.
You almost have to have some sort of belief that even if you can't see it, you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, that the world is coming into being the way it needs to come into being, and you're doing your part, whatever that is.
That's right. Well, and I think, too, this I never saw it before, but as our conversation is unfolding, I'm seeing a foreshadowing of chapter 14 about this, about projection and scapegoating and refusal of personal responsibility, in a sense. Like when we, no matter what place you find yourself on that spectrum of escapism, whether it's escape to heaven or escape to paralysis, there is an assumption that one makes that says the problem is not me.
Yes, right. Like if I can get out,
I'm good.
Right.
You know?
Well,
or if I can just stay here and not do anything.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I'm good.
Yeah. It's not my problem.
Right. Or it's not my responsibility.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that word is becoming central for me as I think about
these chapters. So powerful to think about it that way. It's interesting because what we find out with Jones and others who have thought that way is you can't leave America and leave America behind.
Right.
You can't not do anything and then not be impacted. Right? Like there is no escaping. And where you deal with extremes where you can say, it's all going to hell in a handbag. There's nothing I can do, so I'm going to do this. The reality is that if that's true, then so have you. Like, we're all caught up with it, right? We're all complicit with it. If the land and our bodies are tied together, we're American, right? So we are complicit within all the things that America is doing. We're not like it,
right?
But we are part and parcel with
it.
Yeah, so our only work can be to be in that place, right? Without changing our nationality and taking on a new place, which people do, but like you can't like go to Guyana or commit suicide or give up and think that it's not gonna, that somehow you're not going to be complicit in it anymore. That
well,
you can really escape. You can't really escape.
When it betrays all of the personal relationships and the woven togetherness of society in general, like how many thousands of people, or I don't remember the number of people who drank the Kool-Aid that day.
Yeah, many thousands.
Okay, so how many families were impacted by that?
I know, yeah.
So, yeah.
Lots of people.
Yep. And, I mean, it's become a marker in American history of unhealthy religion.
That's right.
You know, you can't, like, we were joking about, like, what does that make people think about, you know, preacher X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like there are stories that are told that help support the narrative that religion is quote unquote the opiate of the masses,
right?
Or like just
always a tool for manipulation.
Manipulation, right?
You know, never good. It never has. It always is a facade for our unholy aims or intentions.
Yeah. It's escape, not transformation.
Right, right. Yeah. And so you see how like things like the Catholic abuse scandal and what we're seeing happening in evangelical and Baptist churches right now across the country in this sort of new wave of inappropriate behaviors and abuse that's coming out, the scandals, that's going to continue to hurt the image of the church. It's hard to overcome. You know, when you think about it, a marketing problem that we might have as a church with Baptists in our name and being not looking like typical Baptists in the South, I mean, it's just bad to just be a church in America right now, because people are seeing what's happening and they're saying, why would I put my faith in an institution that has protected predators? Right. It doesn't matter what their denomination is. The average person is not sitting around thinking, should I go to Catholic, Episcopalian? No, it's all church. Every story that's negative about church is a story negative about your church. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter.
That's right.
You know, and so we have to wrestle with this question of healthy and unhealthy religion, because it is impacting every congregation and community in the country.
Yep, absolutely. And we find another healthy little table.
Yeah.
If you're listening to Audible, you're going to miss
it. You're going to miss it if you don't have it.
It's on page 182 in the printed book.
If you don't have the embodied book.
The embodied book. Wow.
The incarnate
book.
Hey,
you know what? I'm reading the other one with my ears.
Okay.
That's pretty embodied.
True. That's pretty embodied.
But on 182, Frost lays out traits of healthy and unhealthy churches. And it's kind of an interesting little thing to like to think about your church and try to map it here. So like the first one I love is your church, if it's healthy, right, under the left column, healthy religions, it says, is your church concerned with the pursuit of God? Or, unhealthy column, is it concerned with things to avoid?
Yeah, right. That's good. All right, I'm going to do the next one.
Okay.
Is your church is healthy if, this is like a Jeff Foxworthy thing.
We did that.
See how we come full circle on this podcast? That's intentional. Every bit
church
of it.
Is, you might have a healthy church if you measure godly qualities in people. You might have an unhealthy religion if you measure quantities of giving and service.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so you might have a healthy religion if your church finds its identity in grace rather than an unhealthy religion, which finds its identity in behavior.
Interesting. All right, you might have a healthy religion if you expand life. You might have a healthy religion if you expand life. You might have an unhealthy religion that constricts life.
Yeah. Oh, I got the best one on the whole chart. Healthy religion results in transformation, whereas unhealthy religion simulates holiness.
I love the simulating holiness.
I know.
Isn't that amazing?
It's so good.
Healthy religion seeks wisdom. Unhealthy religion seeks argument. Mm.
Well, that's interesting. Think about our covenant.
Yeah, right? Controversy.
We accept controversy as the reality of life together.
Well, but it's for the purpose
for
of maturity.
The purpose. That's right.
Growing into maturity.
Growing into maturity. That's right. All right. Here we are. So a healthy religion or a healthy community would keep learning as opposed to maintaining blind spots.
Mm.
I think it's so cool that those two are juxtaposed.
I love that.
Right? So to continue learning means you have to acknowledge your blind spots.
Yeah, and you have to keep reading, keep studying, and you're never done. Progressive revelation, right?
That's right.
Well, healthy religion promotes rejoicing. Unhealthy religion promotes suspicion. I love that.
These are such interesting dichotomies.
I know. He's cool.
Healthy religion releases and unhealthy religion suppresses.
I wish that said liberates.
Yeah.
And oppresses. Liberates and oppresses. All right. Unhealthy healthy religion welcomes. Unhealthy religion isolates. Ooh.
I've got a lot to think about here from this chart.
Yeah. That's a good chart.
It is. And I think it's, you know, I'm not sure anybody's got all of these in the right column.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure any church can claim that they've got all these right, particularly not in every aspect of their church. But it's definitely something to wrestle with as you think about what are we focused with? What are we concerned with? Where's our intentionality as a church?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right.
I love that poem that he uses from Adrian Rich at the end of that chapter. I just want to read it. What would it mean to live in a city whose people were changing each other's despair into hope? You yourself must change it. What would it feel like to know your country was changing? You yourself must change it. Though your life felt arduous, new and unmapped and strange, what would it mean to stand up on the first page of the end of despair? Such a cool poem, isn't it?
The word change just jumps off the page at me.
Yeah.
When I read that.
Yeah.
And I think about in churches and then in communities with histories, change is often a really negative word.
Right.
Or it's at least an anxious word.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes change is accelerated or maybe for the first time acknowledged when a person comes in.
Right.
Or when an event happens. And then all of a sudden, everyone's forced to reckon with the change that has been coming.
Yeah.
That no one's wanted to talk about.
No, exactly.
For a long time.
Yeah.
Almost like a scapegoat.
Nice. Look at you finding transitions into the last chapter, Chrissy. So proud.
I'm here to serve.
Yes. So, go ahead.
Confession. This chapter presents the thoughts of Gerard, who I had totally misplaced in history.
Yeah, Rene Gerard.
Until this chapter.
Well, let's get him figured out.
Okay.
Because there's some good stuff here. So this scapegoat idea really can mess with your belief in salvation if you let it. So there are many different atonement theories you've probably heard about over the years. Penal substitutionary atonement. That's the one where you heard Jesus paid it all to him, all to God you owe or whatever.
Well, that's a hymn.
Yeah. So like where Jesus took your place on the cross and you're, because you're a dirty, nasty sinner. And Jesus is not a dirty, nasty sinner. So Jesus dies on the cross in your place and all your dirty, nasty sins go away because Jesus died there. Aren't you glad?
Yep.
You know, that's sort of penal substitutionary atonement. There are other ones where like Christ's death is a victory over all the powers of evil and darkness. That's like the Christus Victor. Look at you. Yes, Gustav Allen. It's sort of so many wonderful Christus Victor. And that's really an old one. Gregory of Nyssa uses that one and others. Then there's the moral influence theory where like Jesus is a good – is like a really awesome moral example. And so like – and you just follow his moral example and then you become a great moral example and you're saved.
That's the hippie one.
That's
the
– yeah. But it's actually pretty old. Abelard is like medieval period, 1000 AD, you know. So then this – a very recent atonement theory is Rene Girard's that sort of holds that he's a sociologist. So he talks about how all societies scapegoat people. Yep. And they use scapegoating as a way to like put the sins of their culture onto one group of people or one person. And then they kill that one person and they think that it's gone away. But in fact, they just continue to create the cycle of violence. And then the new scapegoat comes in and they follow the same pattern. So,
right. If you have any questions about how this plays out in American history, just look at our immigration laws.
Exactly. Well, there are many other forms. Or like historically over the course of nations throughout the world history,
right.
Jewish people are like the
– That's right. The number one scapegoat.
Number one scapegoat of all time. So Germany, 1930.
Yeah.
Think about that, right? You know, or Russia or – for you know, there's so many different ways of thinking about the scapegoat theory and how it works. So what Gerard says is that Jesus sort of follows all these patterns of scapegoating by becoming the person that all of the society puts their sins upon. Mm-hmm. And even though he's innocent, declared innocent, you know, by the resurrection or however you think about the gospel, he is crucified as the sacrifice. Like he's the scapegoat sacrifice who's crucified as for the sins of all people. So it feels kind of like the replacement, penal substitutionary replacement mm-hmm. atonement. But here's where Gerard kind of flips the tables on you. Jesus is the last sacrifice of all sacrifices. He's the last scapegoat. And after Jesus, what the community of followers of Jesus begin to believe is there can never be another scapegoat.
Right.
So there's so that's how they're able to create a community where there are no scapegoats, where there is no male nor female or Jew nor Greek or slave nor free. There are no Roman or Jew. There are no scapegoats. There's no male or female scapegoats. And then they continually ritualize the practice of the cross as a way to remind them that all scapegoating is gone and that Jesus was the last and final scapegoat and that there are no scapegoats in their community because their community is a place free of scapegoating, free of violence that comes from scapegoating,
right.
A place of peace. So that's what the Eucharist or communion does.
Right. And for Gerard, who again is not a theologian but a philosopher, this I think these phrases from Frost's book really help kind of pull all of that together. So he says he was identified, speaking of Jesus, so Jesus was identified by the religious authorities of his day as a threat to their position and authority, and they scapegoated him.
Yeah.
So a threat to their position and authority, and I would even add, just as a contemporary reader, to their economy.
Yeah, and their power.
And their
economic
power. And they scapegoated him. But Gerard goes further. He says that the resurrection of Jesus from the dead proves him to have been innocent.
Mm.
So it's not just the gospel narrative of Jesus' life with the affirmations of innocence, but it's the fact that he was resurrected. And then humanity, in response to the resurrection, is made aware of it, of its own violent tendencies.
Right.
And that's how the cycle is broken.
Well, and the cycle is also broken because Jesus does not come back and exert revenge on those who killed him.
Right.
So the way that the cycle is closed forever is that there's no punishment for Pilate.
Right.
There's no murder of the Roman centurions who killed him.
It's like they're playing tennis and Jesus just catches the ball.
Yeah. That's like the least violent version of that. But yes, that's so funny.
I'm always here to provide a sports
wonderful
analogy.
Yeah. No, you're not going to get those from me. So I think of it more like there's a systemic pattern of like the Hatfields and McCoys killing each other, or the Romeo and Juliets, the Capulets and the Montagues killing each other, killing each other, killing each other. And then one of them, their wife or daughter or son or gets killed, and they say they come back, and instead of killing the other one, they just offer peace and love.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
That's like exactly that's forgiveness. That's what the whole gospel is about, right?
Yeah.
And so that's what scapegoating theory says, is that the cross is the end of all scapegoating, the end. It should be the end of all violence by Christians, at least, by the followers of Jesus.
Yeah, violence, ideological violence and physical violence.
Yeah, why would you ever – what's the reason you would ever kill anybody?
Exactly.
There are no scapegoats.
That's right.
There's no reason to kill anybody. There's just human beings that should be a part of your community.
That's right. And I think one of the really important pieces of this as it relates to incarnational theology or embodied spiritual practice is the concept of Eucharist as ritual and as a piece of our practice that constantly serves to remind us that there are no more scapegoats.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
There's no more violence.
And there's no more bodies that need to be killed so that the rest of the bodies can survive. Like, that's the incarnate part of it, I think.
Right. So what if, we talk a lot about, like, what if we live like this is true in our settings?
Yeah.
So what does it mean to believe that there is no more scapegoating and that bodies don't need to be harmed for my own security?
Right.
What does that mean for me if I take the bread and take the wine and remember that promise and then go live my life on Monday?
Yeah, I mean, I think it means – well, I don't know exactly what it means. I think it means that you're not going to find yourself in a place where a body that is different is a body that should be cast aside or treated unfairly or inhumanely simply because of its body,
right?
So like I always think it's interesting and instructive that the Nazis not only murdered Jews but also disabled people.
That's right.
Because a body, a deformed body, right, a Jewish body or a deformed body or a handicapped body or a disabled body for them didn't work within their scientific, racial, bodily schematic.
Right.
So they had to get rid of those bodies. So I think to me, we should be, as people who follow the sort of broken, disabled, crucified God, Jesus, that died on the cross, whatever you want to think about that, we should be looking at bodies that are vulnerable as bodies that are the most holy, right? Mm-hmm. It's like sort of blessed are the poor, blessed are the merciful, blessed are those. It's the touching of the leper, the willingness to be identified with the leper, or even to take on and contract the illness of the leper because you're so close. And the being with the physically disabled, the man who's laying beside the pool because he's too infirm, and the woman with the hemorrhage.
Yeah. Well, I think about – I kind of love that he kind of finishes the book with an incarnational understanding of Eucharist.
Yes.
Because I have struggled with the rhythm of – I mean, I love communion. It's my favorite sacrament or ordinance or religious practice or whatever you call it, because of the earthiness of it and kind of the rhythm of it. But I love connecting it to the incarnational nature of our practice of faith.
Yeah.
So that's a gift that I think this book, and especially the last chapter, in really breaking down the scapegoat piece, it's been a real learning for me.
Well, I love the fact that he sort of ends with Eucharist, but he ties Eucharist back to the incarnation.
Yeah.
Which is sort of, you always wonder why you're doing Eucharist on Christmas.
Because
it's like, isn't that Easter?
Yeah.
Isn't that the story? But in fact, Frost would argue that it's the most appropriate time to do communion because it's the most incarnational practice we have as Christians. It's full bodily. It affirms the bodily the body of the crucifixion and affirms the, you know, it's a body of Christ given for you, right?
Yeah,
it's
the most incarnate, yeah, nourish your body,
you know. And it's interesting because he uses in the epilogue, as he's coming to the conclusion, he uses these quotes from C.S. Lewis. It says, "Our imitation of God in this life must be an imitation of God incarnate. Our model is the Jesus, not of Calvary only, but the workshop, the roads, the crowds, the clamorous demands and surly oppositions, the lack of all peace and privacy, the Jesus of interruptions." Mm. You know, it's like the incarnate Jesus is the Jesus we must imitate in life. We don't get to imitate the divine one because we're not divine.
Right.
We get to do the body side, the fully human, because we're fully human, right?
Well, that's a healthy reminder.
Yeah, I think this is amazing how he really reaffirms the incarnation's connection to these other practices.
Yeah.
And, you know, speaking of communion and Christmas, you'll get your chance to take communion this Christmas if you come to worship, 6 p.m., December 24th, and
that's
also
right.
on January 6th. And we'll be doing
jazz.
Yeah, all kinds of different
worship. Oh, jazz is December 30th.
No, that's right. And Epiphany is on 6th. But we'll have communion both times.
So just come on a Sunday. We'll be doing something interesting and embodied.
All right, Chrissy, it's been a joy.
It's been fun. See you sometime.
Bye.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.